I really enjoyed this book.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
So glad. I always write with women in mind, and I'm in trouble just for saying that, I suppose. But then I realized when I wrote Icemen that there probably would be a number of women readers who just think, well, this is a war novel and I'm not interested. But each time out, I write for myself, first of all, and I like romance in a novel. So when I did this novel, I thought, let's put some romance in there. And one of the regrets I have is I don't know really who's buying this novel, but I had some women readers built up from medical thrillers and things like that that I've done, and they may have felt abandoned when they saw Icemen come out. I don't know.
Oh, well, that's interesting. So even for science fiction and some of the other books you've written, you've had women readers in mind?
I wouldn't say I did right from the very start, because I was just almost still a kid when I wrote my first book, and I was a typical adolescent male and reading science fiction, enjoying it, you know, and so that was the first thing that occurred to me to write. And I didn't think too much about women readers in those days until I read a statistic that 80% of all books are bought by women.
Yeah, that's true.
And I thought, you know, you better wise up. Plus, I like women. And, you know, I think every guy has some woman in him and vice versa for women. You know, so you try to write for everyone. But if you're smart, you'll write for the largest part of the market, which is women readers.
Now, you've contributed quite a bit to science fiction, though. Correct me if I'm wrong. Isn't that particular genre more male-oriented, or no?
I think you're right. And I used to go to the science fiction conventions early in my career, and there were relatively few women writers. There were some very prominent ones, Ursula Le Guin, and, you know, Kate Wilhelm started out in that, I think. Women would come to the panels and that kind of thing, and we would all talk about how it would be nice if more women read science fiction and wrote it. Mm-hmm. But as far as I can tell, it still tends to lean toward the male reader, and that is one reason I think I edged out of it finally. But I think you're right.
First, let's go back in time a little bit. I was intrigued that I saw on your webpage where you wrote a little bit about your background that mom called you an absent-minded professor. I related because my mom did too.
No kidding. Well, that's amazing, yes.
So I thought, this is going to be a good interview. We're going to go off on all these fascinating tangents.
Without a doubt. You catch me if I start doing that too much, but yes.
Oh, I think it's fun. So let's talk about your background. You're originally from Battle Creek.
That's right. I was born in, it wasn't Lila Hospital, it was Community Hospital. Back when that was still there, I'm not sure it is anymore, but back in 1946. And I lived mostly in one home from the time I was four, very close to what was then the Battle Creek Sanitarium on one end of Oaklawn Avenue. And at the other end, there was the old Kellogg Estate, which was still there. It was this great big Victorian house made mostly of wood, I guess, because it really did burn down and with tremendous hot flames one night. But it was a beautiful street. We had elm trees. We could go out. It was only a 3.5-block long street, so we kids could go out and, you know, toss the ball back and forth with only an occasional car. And I just loved Battle Creek. I loved growing up there. I didn't know anything else, but I liked what I had, and I was there until after college. So,
and is that correct that your first story was published in Battle Creek? Was it in the Enquirer or somewhere else?
No, it was in the Enquirer. I was lucky to have an English teacher who encouraged me, and he said, "You want to try to write something for the Enquirer." So I wrote a short piece about skiing. In those days, almost everything I wrote, for some reason, I thought I would write to be funny. Now, that's actually very hard to do. But in those days as a kid, I liked joking around. And so I wrote what we will call a humorous piece on skiing. And I remember the first line was, "Skiing is my hobby, and someday I'd like to try it." And I don't remember anything else about it, but I got $3 for it.
Hey, that's something. A lot of times there's nothing.
Yeah, exactly right.
Almost get a coffee for that.
Exactly right. Well, then, of course, this was back in, I suppose, when I was a junior in high school, probably. That would have been 1963. So $3 then might have been $10 now. I don't know.
There you go. So how is writing like a clinical psychologist? Now, I understand when you went to college, now that we've brought you up to college age, you were a psych major, but then you turned to biology?
Well, no, I was actually a bio major first, and then I was trying to put together a minor in chemistry, and I just didn't feel that interested in it. And so late in my college years, I put together a minor in psychology and graduated with a BA in biology with a minor in psych. And I came out, worked in a lab for a few years here in Virginia, and wanted to go back to grad school, but not in biology. I had remembered the psych courses, thought they were interesting. So I applied over at Catholic and got into their clinical program. And that's where I finished up in 1981.
And you wrote a nonfiction book called Absorbing SpongeBob.
Right.
Anybody with kids, at least, would probably know what that's about. And the subtitle was 10 Ways to Squeeze More Happiness Out of Life. So that sounds like a lot of fun. So before we turn to this particular novel, tell us a little bit more about that. And how important is it for a writer to also to be something of a psychologist? I mean, after all, isn't writing a great deal about human psychology?
I agree with you completely. And I think all of the best writers are natively psychologists. That's what they are. They're people who are perhaps a little more observant just because they're interested. They have an innate interest in other people, and they watch them and they study them, and they take a little more out of their interactions with them, and that's basically what a psychologist is supposed to do. And I think so. I think the a lot of the writers I like show some flair for the human psyche. You have to be a little careful with it, particularly once you've been educated in it, because academic writing is just so different from fiction writing. And I found myself having to sort of scrub out the jargon and that sort of thing when I try to use what I know about psychology in a book, because that's very off-putting. But what you say is right. A lot of the writers, the best ones, I think, are people who are really observant of other people, and they know more about how they tick, because I think that's why people read. They read to experience life through the viewpoint of another character.
And perhaps understand themselves better in the process?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So without giving away, because we want people to buy all your books, but you say 10 ways to squeeze happiness out of life. So give us one or two.
Well, let's see. I should have had the book here with me. I talked of one way was I noticed in my own training that there seemed to be two basic classes of people, and they don't divide 50-50, interestingly enough. They're what Hans Eysenck called extroverts and introverts, but it's a little different from the typical meaning of those words. Your introvert is a person who is easily overstimulated and overwhelmed by too much stimulation, and about 30% of people are that way when they take the test that Eysenck devised, and 70% of people are extroverts, which is to say that they're your speedboat racers, your car racers, people who just can't get enough stimulation in life. And this really cuts across whether you like people or not. You've got Eysenck introverts who love people and can't get enough of people, although any Eysenck introvert can get too much of anything rather quickly. So that was a point in the book that I remember talking about. You have to know what you are. It helps anyway.
Sure.
And then you can protect yourself a little bit. You can take if you're an Eysenck introvert but you love people, well, you take people in smaller doses. You can also be an Eysenck extrovert and could care less about people. An example of that might be the guy climbs on a sailboat and goes solo around the world. That's way too much stimulation for me, but there are people who would like to do that. And so I think I started out the book with that, as I recall, and I went on to look at various characterological things. That show was the first three seasons of that show. It had a sneaky adult subtext to it. And then Steven Hillenburg, who had created the show, left, and it went more basically children after that. But at the point I wrote the book, it was about the third season, and my editor at Berkeley had pitched it to me. She had heard me say I liked the show, and she said, well, why don't you you know, write a book about it for us. And it was a very interesting thing for me to do. I had never done nonfiction before. It sounds odd to say that SpongeBob would be nonfiction, but he's a real cultural phenomenon. So, and that's what I was writing about, actually. So It was a lot of fun. It was much easier than writing novels, and wouldn't mind doing it again at some point.
So Icemen, the novel that we want to talk about today, Icemen, a novel of the Korean War. And I did read it with fascination because my father served in the Korean War. And I thought, you know, I really don't know all that much about it. So it was interesting to read. At the same time, why this particular war? Are all wars essentially the same, do you think? Or how does this one differ? Why did you choose this particular war?
I chose this one. I can remember seeing my father's uniform hang in the basement. He was in the U.S. Army Air Corps in World War II, And he was actually one of the older fellows to go. I think he was nearly 30 when he went, or late 20s. And I got interested in that uniform. I was 4 years old when the Korean War started, and I thought nothing of it at the time because I heard nothing about it. That war went on from the time I was four till I was seven. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, why don't I know more about this? And I actually made something of a mistake. I went into a bookstore and I looked, and there were these walls of books on World War II and walls of books on the Vietnam War. And there were two bookshelves shorter than my arm span with books about the Korean War. So I thought, well, boy, that's a open part of the market. We need more books about that. So that was what started me off. And, of course, the flip side of that is there's a reason why there's only two short bookshelves on the Korean War, and that is that there's a perception that there's not an interest in that war, and I dispute that. I think that's unfair to the veterans. There are a couple hundred thousand of them still around. Mm-hmm. And once I got going, that was my main motivation, is because I know a lot of these people didn't talk to their kids. I think war, particularly back then, I think war is changing. It's becoming higher tech. Mm. And, you know, people are sitting in a little hut in Nebraska, and they're, you know, making a missile strike in some far-flung part of the world now. That wasn't the case in those days. And as you know from reading the novel, I mean, people were charging up hills, and there was, you know, it was a lot of mayhem and just really horrible. And I wanted to know, by getting into the viewpoints of three different characters, just get some sense of that myself by making myself think about it, think how it must have felt, and go from there, you know. It was difficult to research. There wasn't a lot written about it. I did my level best to make sure that all the movements of X Corps, which is the novel's main subject, were as they happened. And that turned out to be harder than I thought it would be. But eventually was able to run down what I needed to get a clear picture for the period that I cover in the novel.
Did you have a chance to talk to some veterans?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. I talked to one guy. I remember Lou Ligari was a corpsman. He was in the Navy, but the Navy provided the medics, as it were, for the Marine Corps. And they're called corpsmen. And he was actually a corpsman at the Chosin Reservoir. And he is the fellow that told me about putting syrettes of morphine in his mouth to keep them from freezing, so that he could give the wounded morphine without it, you know, without it having been frozen and unable to be given. And he talked about scrambling around in the Taebaek Mountains at 35 below zero, helping these wounded men, and it was very, very moving to talk to him. And I talked to some others as well.
Did he have a chance to read the finished book?
Yeah, he did, and I think I acknowledged him in the acknowledgments of the book. And he told me it was pretty good. That the one thing that he didn't remember was leggings. I mentioned leggings a couple of times in the book, and he didn't remember ever wearing leggings. So I guess that was something some Marines wore and others didn't. And of course, he was a corpsman, so maybe that was why. I don't know. But he did like the book. I was very happy about that.
So for our listeners, Steve, can you give us just a little nutshell of the plot inside this setting of the Korean War and these three characters that you write about?
Sure. I felt it was important that they be connected to each other. And one of the characters is, a Marine sergeant, a veteran of World War II, and a career soldier. And then we have his callow son, Sam, who is you know, an army reservist, thought the uniform would look neat, good way to get dates. And then we have a MASH nurse who came up in a poor family, much like my mother did. And I sort of borrowed from my mother's personal history for her personal history. And she gets herself through nursing school by joining the Army. And she goes up in a household of nothing but women, just her sister, and her mother, her father having left them. And I thought that would be interesting, too, a woman going across into a faraway place across the sea and then being suddenly around nothing but men. What would that be like? Mm-hmm. And so she meets these two men and develops a relationship with each of them. And that sort of forms the nucleus of the personal part of the novel, apart from the history that these people live through. Their feelings for each other were the most interesting part for me, the most fun to work on, too.
You know, I sometimes wonder when and one of your characters, as you said, is a career military person, and I sometimes wonder if people like that remain in the military for their careers because it becomes so difficult, if not impossible, to come back into civilian life.
Mm-hmm. I think that's very true, and we find that now with our current veterans who've gone over to Iraq and places like Afghanistan and seen things that most of us never see and go through things we have just cannot imagine enduring. And they suddenly feel unfit to be back where they once felt comfortable. And so a lot of them will reenlist. They'll make careers out of it. And there are, from what I gather, and I haven't made an extensive study of this, but from what I read, there's a great deal of adjustment problems for soldiers right now coming back from some of these wars. We seem to always be in some kind of a conflict. And I think
we're finally admitting to PTSD. You know,
absolutely.
These tough people coming back have a tough time admitting that something isn't right.
Yes. They can't even put their finger on it themselves. They have nightmares. One of my internships in my clinical training was at the Washington VA hospital, and I got to see a number of these men. And a lot of times they can't tell you what it is, but they're suffering. They're having terrible nightmares. They're losing sleep. And it's a tremendous adjustment. We owe them all the help we can give them, that's for sure.
Absolutely. And as the writer of something like, you haven't been in the military yourself?
No, I went and volunteered in 1968.
Okay.
Yeah, I got out. Well, I volunteered and I'd gotten out of college. I'd had my 2S deferment for 4 years, mm-hmm. and my high school friends had gone. And I thought, it's time for you to go. And, of course, this was right about the height of the war. And you're that age, you don't think you can be killed. You think it'll be a big adventure, you know. So I volunteered, and I remember I got a send-off from the lady, Elizabeth Ford, who was the draft person there in Battle Creek, got on a bus, went to Detroit, and I was very fit and strong in those days. I had played football and lifted weights and everything else, and I flunked the physical.
Oh.
I had high blood pressure. And
that'll do it.
Didn't know it. And here I was with 170 guys in our boxer shorts, right, mm-hmm. Being told to grab our ankles and bend over. I don't know why they didn't all have high blood pressure, but they did.
Yeah.
And I did. And so that was the end of that. Went back home and, you know, was called up repeatedly, but I've had the high blood pressure the rest of my life, so...
So writing something like this, writing anything, you have to, as a writer, immerse yourself as deeply as you can. Certainly, that's how I approach it. But when you write about war, that's more difficult, I would think, than just about any other subject matter you could take on. What did that do to you, that process? How did you stay well? How did you keep your blood pressure down?
Good question. Fortunately, they do have pills for that. But I suppose if I had monitored my blood pressure while I was writing those scenes, I might have seen an uptick. Because you're right, it is, you know, if you're going to do that right, you have to get inside the skin of these characters. And you know, once you do that, if it's a war novel, I'm not sure I would write another war novel because that was difficult. And you know, when I had to. I don't want to go too far and spoil the novel for anyone, but when you lose a character,
yeah.
you know, that you've invested yourself in, that it brings tears.
Oh, it's grief. And, absolutely. Yeah, you've lost someone in your life. Yeah,
definitely. And even though in the novel, that person wasn't real, he was real to me. And so, yeah, that does put strains on you that the other novels I've written certainly haven't.
You've called this at one point, I believe I saw somewhere, your magnum opus. Yet you usually write science fiction, thrillers, some history. Where are you more comfortable? And you did just say that you may not be writing another war book.
No, I probably won't. I'm currently working on a novel about an archaeological thriller that's set in the present, and it's about Ramses II. The great pharaoh of the 19th dynasty and the new kingdom.
So we've got some time traveling back here.
Yes, we will have a scene in his palace and had to do a lot of research to find out what that was like because we're talking about 3,200 years ago. And I have had such fun doing this. It's probably a better thing for my blood pressure than Iceman was. And I've learned all about this fellow Ramses, who was an amazing king of Egypt. And the novel takes place in the here and now, though, for the most part, with an archaeologist going after something that he left buried in one of his temples. Mm-hmm. And that's just been more fun. But the research has again been daunting. I was about to write a scene in which some money changed hands, and I thought, you better check that. Did they have money back then? And they didn't. So
there you go.
Yeah, evidently a person would work a day or two for some beer and some bread, maybe some cloth, and if you did something big like become
more of a barter system. Then.
Yes, it was a barter system, and you can't get any of those. People will believe love at first sight, but they won't believe that the Egyptians had money. So someone will catch you on that if you do it. So
yeah.
And they should. You know, you should do everything you can to avoid any mistakes like that.
Oh, absolutely. So how close to finish are you on that one?
Very close. I'm really going through the final edit now and just trying to. I decided that one character in the novel who had a viewpoint. A point of view. He had several chapters in which you see things through his eyes. Mm-hmm. Would it really be better if he was not, if he was seen from outside by the other characters? And so that takes a certain amount of re-engineering and rewriting, and that's what I'm doing. When that's done, I'll be turning it in. So.
And you have, correct me if I'm wrong, 16 novels to your name?
That's right. One of them is a novella. So I try to be as scrupulously honest as I can be. There's 15 and a half. The novella is Janus Equation, done way back in the early part of my career, that was part of a double. Dell was putting out double novellas. Mm-hmm. The whole thing was about the length of a novel, and I did half of one of those, and then 15 besides, and then the SpongeBob book. So I guess Ramses will be my 17th novel.
Prolific.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I envy
that.
I wish
it was more.
I think entirely or most of your books are through Doubleday and St. Martin's Press, but it looks like Iceman, is that one that you did on your own?
Yes, there's a...
And what was that choice about?
Well, it's just kind of a horrible story. I'm glad you raised it because when I mentioned early on about going to the bookstore and seeing two bookshelves with maybe 3 feet worth of book on them. Well, when I got done with Iceman, both my editor at St. Martin's and Doubleday said, "Yeah, this is good, but we don't think anyone cares about the Korean War."
Oh, wow.
And that was a real shock to me because, yeah. And you know, the business has changed too. Doubleday used to be the Doubleday family.
Yeah.
Now it's owned by Bertelsmann, a great big German corporation. And, you know, what they decide to publish has changed over the years since I broke in back in the 70s. It used to be a novel, if it was done well, above a certain standard, and it was interesting and had something to say, chances are it would be bought and published.
Right.
And that's how it was when I broke in. It's much less that way now. I was so incensed about that. I felt, you know, I'd gotten so involved in the lives of these people and talked to so many veterans and all the rest of it. And so I just went ahead and published it myself using what was then BookSurge. Mm-hmm. That's Amazon affiliate, and I think it's called CreateSpace now. Mm-hmm. But they did a very good job. They provide a publish on demand. In other words, if you'd like to have a copy, an actual book to hold in your hand, they can do that, send it to you, or they can do it, put it on your Kindle. So that was a decision I made not to let this go. You know, every once in a while,
good for you.
Well, thank you. I my wife is also urging me, no, you can't let this just sit on your shelf. You have to get this out. So, and I feel it's been well received. I was going to ask you,
what kind of response, is it more challenging for you as an author to market it? Or one hears these days with traditional publishing houses that marketing falls pretty much on the author's shoulders anyway.
It does. And in my career, you know, most people will not recognize, Spruill won't leap off the shelf of their mind as a household word. It's I was a what you would call a mid-list writer for many years, and publishers had a number of these in every house. They filled certain niches that people were interested in, and they made a good profit off of those writers in the aggregate. But with the new attitude in publishing seems to be, we want only bestsellers. So, and of course, that's extremely hard to predict. What's going to be a best? Nowadays, you know, a book like Iceman might not be published. It certainly wasn't for me, and so I did it myself, and it has done fairly well. You make a little more money this way, actually, for each book that sells, because your royalty cut is bigger. I think that's
fewer middlemen.
Yes, fewer middlemen. There's just you and Amazon in the case of Book Surge, and they give you a perfectly good, you know, website space there. And you know, presumably I probably had some fans from earlier books that had been published by Doubledan St. Martin's, and maybe some of them bought the book. And I think there was a lot of interest among veterans also.
Yeah.
They're the ones who go into the bookstore and see those two short shelves and feel bad. They feel like they've been, you know, not appreciated. And they like to read about themselves and what they went through. And I've had some good feedback from veterans as well. So that's been nice.
Tell us a little bit about this particular procedure that you write about in the book that that was against the rules, against the regulations.
Yes, it was the procedure was a graft, venous graft. They had just learned how to do that at I think Boston General Hospital or one of those East Coast big hospitals. And a lot of the fellows that went, the doctors who were drafted and ended up in the MASHes, had the latest research on their minds and were willing to try it out. And the pro side of that was that they could save many limbs that would otherwise have been lost and were lost in World War II by doing a graft, restoring blood to that injured limb so that it wouldn't become gangrenous and have to be amputated. From the Army standpoint, the problem was that it felt a little bit like using these wounded men as guinea pigs, because this was still an extremely new technique. And so that was the crux of the problem. And as I understand it, the doctors got around that by just doing it anyway and facing problems.
So that is factual, that doctors did it anyway?
Okay. Yes, I think that's right. In fact, I did, as I recall, I got that from a book by Dr. Apple, who was a MASH doctor, and I believe he talked about that in his book. Unfortunately, it's been a couple of years now, so I'm not as fresh on the research as I once was, but this would be Chapter 8, and I don't know if this is the one where they do a venous graft or not. Maybe I should just look ahead here and see. And you don't want that much anyway, probably just a page.
No, just a paragraph or so, yeah.
Okay, all right then. Let me just read the first part of this, give people the idea of being in a...
The tone of the novel.
Okay. This is Chapter 8, First MASH Inchon, 2023 Hours. It's only pain, Bonnie told herself. After 7 hours in surgery, her spine throbbed and her shoulder blades ached. She stepped away from the table so orderlies could remove the pneumothorax. As they carried the GI away to post-op, she flexed her knees and bent forward, sneaking a glance at Jeff. Bloody gloved hands on his hips, he had bent over so far backward, she could see the stubbly base of his chin under his surgical mask. He hadn't sat down the whole 7 hours either. No chance, really. Their standing bet concerned exactly that, who could stay on their feet longest if the going got tough. It was tough now. Her calves pulsed. She could get her weight off in just a few minutes. The orderlies hustled in with another litter.